to take pleasure and satisfaction and happiness and bliss from these conversations with Allah. Now sure, the dua, the supplication, the salah, the daily obligatory prayers, and the qunut, where we raise our hands in the second rak'ah, the second unit of our daily wajib prayers, these are all different instances of one thing, and that is the conversation with the Almighty Allah. Via a ziyarat, we recite a different conversation. Via a supplication or a dua, like dua kumal, or dua tawassul, or dua joshan kabir, dua joshan saghir, and all these other daily du'as, the ta'aqibat namaz, the du'as after each of the five daily prayers, the daily prayers themselves, the salah, and even the recitation of the Holy Qur'an, these are all different instances of our conversations with Allah. Each conversation being different within its own conditions and its own framework. And dear friends, if we were to continue these prayers and these du'as and these supplications and all of this ubudiyah and all of this worship and servitude and obedience, if we continued all of this for a while and we became habituated to these things, we became accustomed to these things, and we became cordially familiar with each and every one, then in this very world, let alone the next world, we would actually receive so much pleasure and satisfaction out of these conversations with Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. A pleasure and a satisfaction, of course, which cannot be compared with anything or anyone else, or even any of the other pleasures and satisfactions of this materialistic world. Now, for anybody who observes and studies the states of those people who are supplicating, it will be quite obvious that those people who supplicate and pray and do du'as and do the prayers and do the salah and do the recitation of the Qur'an via the depths of their heart and soul, you will see the pleasure and satisfaction that they receive via these conversations with their loving, nourishing Lord, Allah, the Almighty, the Exalted.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com. Dear listeners of the program Foresight, my name is Muhammad. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from Munajatul Muhibbin, which means the whispered prayer of the lovers. Stay with me. نهاري دونكم ليل وليلي كله O God, place us among those whose habit is rejoicing in you and yearning for you, whose time is spent in sighing and moaning. Their foreheads are bowed down before your mightiness, their eyes wakeful in your service, their tears flowing in dread of you, their hearts fixed upon your love, their cores shaken with awe of you. O He, the lights of whose holiness induce wonder in the eyes of His lovers, the glories of whose face arouse the longing of the hearts of his knowers. O furthest wish of the hearts of the yearners, O God, O utmost limit of the hopes of the lovers, I ask from you, love for those who love you, love for every work which will join me to your nearness, and that you make yourself more beloved to me than anything other than you. And make my love for you lead to your good pleasure, and my yearning for you protect against disobeying you. Oblige me by allowing me to gaze upon you. Gaze upon me with the eye of affection and tenderness. Turn not your face away from me, and make me one of the people of happiness with you and favored position. O responder, O most merciful of the merciful. فإن غبتم فلا صبر ولا جلد ولا رمق بكم يحيى إذا زرتم وتفرح باللقاء الحدق فإن غبتم فلا صبر ولا جلد ولا رمق ولا العبد الفقير ولا. Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. Now, we're talking about the pleasure and satisfaction that an individual will get in their conversations with Allah, in these conversations which are manifested in multiple different manners and ways, such as the du'as, supplications, such as the ziyarat, such as the recitation of the Qur'an, and of course, such as the recitation of the five daily prayers, the namaz, and the salah. Of course, we said that we can't do it every now and then and expect to get pleasure and satisfaction out of these different conversations with the Almighty Allah. We have to do them in a repetitive manner, continuously, and of course, with presence of mind and heart. Now, in this segment, as a last point, of course, we want to kind of just generally some of our discussions from various different episodes that we have had. So we need to, first and foremost, when it comes to our ubudiyah, is to have a comprehension of the greatness, the beauty, and the majesty of Allah. And we can do this either by means of logical reasoning and proofs and evidence, or we can also do it, and or we can also do it, through the explanations of the holy prophets and the infallible imams and the holy Quran. Once we have gathered this reasoning and this proof via either logic or via certain texts and traditions regarding the greatness and the beauty and the majesty of the Almighty Allah, we must constantly remind our heart of this. And then via these gradual and continuous remindings, we enter into a continual and a continuous nonstop dhikr, remembrance of Allah, which of course will in turn bring a state of submission to our heart, and we will slowly but surely move towards the perfection of our ubudiyah, our servitude and our obedience to Allah the Almighty, of course with Allah's favor and grace.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
أجب دعائي يا رجائي بالرضا والخير أنر طريقي مع صديقي باحترام الغير.
And now we will listen to Sheikh Zayd Al-Salami, who will talk about today's topic.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد. As a Muslim, I know I believe in one God. I know I have faith in the uniqueness of Almighty God, I also believe that I have a duty and a responsibility to show and express my obedience by worshipping the Almighty. Ultimately, there is a purpose for me living on this earth, and for me to understand the greater meaning of life, I need to look into what I can do to bring about the better aspects of how I live, to find and discover hidden dimensions in my spiritual life. And that's why in this ayah, the third part, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, وَأَقِمِ الصَّلَاةَ لِذِكْرِي. The circumstance of me believing in one God, obeying one God, worshipping one God, is embodied in remembrance of the Almighty. And the most effective, the most productive, the most strong way of me getting to that level is by prayer, by salah, by qurratul ayn, as the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi has said, the pleasure of his eye. He had expressed how he is devoted to prayer. And that's why when one wants to be steadfast in the path of God, when one wants to make sure that even though they might have a very busy routine in their daily activities, when it comes to dhikrullah, when it comes to remembering God, when it comes to praying and showing that level of dedication in their act of worship, prayer in itself is the best and most effective way of bringing about all of those hidden aspects of our lives. And this is why when I remember God, it prevents me from doing many other things that I should be away from. When I do remember God and roll out that prayer mat and pray to God, I am appreciating absolutely everything that I have. That will lead me to understanding what the purpose of life is. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. أحتمي بحما حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير حسبنا الله.
يوسف جلالي بتهران.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Due to the conflict in Ukraine and Western sanctions against Russia, it has never been more costly to buy essential food items in the European Union, and the situation is set to get much worse. The world's biggest wheat producer is Russia. The third largest is Ukraine.
Wheat is a very good example. When I say wheat, we are actually talking about bread to feed people.
In fact, wheat prices have risen by 70%. The European Commission has just unveiled plans to support food producers and reduce tax to 0% on certain food items. €330 million has been announced to support Ukrainian farmers.
They need, for the spring sowing campaign, they need 50,000 tons of fuel per week.
Animal feed stocks are on the decline. Campaigners say millions could starve in East Africa if EU leaders don't do more to help poorer nations. Syria and Yemen have also been singled out for needing special support.
There are in fact 14 low-income countries which depend for more than 50% of their wheat imports on these two countries, on Ukraine and Russia.
The European Commission has presented new legislation to make it mandatory for member states to ensure 80% gas reserves are put in place before November. Experts say that is wishful thinking. 3.5 million Ukrainian refugees have now arrived in the EU. Most countries in the bloc have failed to take in their fair share, but some already have.
Poland is in top. The country number two is Austria. The country number three is Cyprus. Country number four is Czech Republic.
Almost €3.5 billion has been set aside from the EU budget to support refugees, including 1,470 unaccompanied children who have arrived in the bloc from Ukraine. Some nations are saying it's simply not enough money. EU leaders will hold a summit here on Thursday and Friday to consider, amongst other things, a request from Poland for new funding towards the cost of dealing with the growing refugee crisis. All indications so far suggest that request will be rejected. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Over the past week in France, social unrest has been a near daily occurrence. But it may be an everyday issue now and until after the presidential election. Public transport unions in Paris have called an unlimited strike starting March 25th over rampant inflation. Reduced purchasing power was the number one election issue in 2017 and 2012, but the unrest in Ukraine and the European Union's response to it has sent costs haywire. The increases arrive after a decade of right-wing austerity measures, which suppressed wages, reduced social services, and decreased job stability, leaving the average person especially vulnerable to record-high prices. Across the nation, unions were already protesting in an immediate response to President Emmanuel Macron's promise to raise the retirement age to 65. It's a bold gambit, given how unpopular such a change would be. But Macron appears to be betting that polls are correct and that he'll win re-election.
Plenty of people died before the age of 65. Can they never retire? Plenty of workers have physically demanding jobs and are poorly paid. Should they live in poverty and work until their death as well? 65 is way too late, and it's another step too far by Macron.
Austerity, then the coronavirus, now the Ukraine-related instability. Many say France is on the brink of a return to yellow vest levels of unrest if more far-right economic policies are demanded of the average person, but not of the rich.
Raising the retirement age is a certain way to reduce the number of available jobs. So from an economic point of view, not only would this not solve our unemployment problems, but it will actually be counterproductive. Macron is doing things from a purely ideological perspective and not at all with a view of helping the people of France.
France's presidential election has been dominated by disinterest. Voters have tuned out a campaign which was based on Islamophobia and xenophobia, and then the unrest in faraway Ukraine. Many wonder if Macron's call to raise the retirement age may have awoken a sleeping giant, the French public.
France seems to be ignoring or has forgotten about the presidential election, but regular protests are reminding the country of the long-running domestic issues which France still faces. Some of the answers may be fought out in the streets over the next month. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
A delegation from the International Academic Campaign Against Occupation and Apartheid headed to the offices of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, OHCHR, as well as the UN Special Coordinator's Office, UNSCO, in Gaza. They handed the memorandum on Israeli apartheid signed by around 70 international organizations, human rights networks, academics, and researchers from 45 countries. The campaign is calling on the United Nations and Western countries to impose sanctions on the Israeli regime for its occupation of the Palestinian territories and its apartheid regime. The Israeli regime is an occupying power and has kept the Gaza Strip under a crippling blockade since 2007 and also waged four wars on the tiny enclave.
We are here to condemn Israeli apartheid, and we call on the international community to support the Palestinian people. We also demand and end Israeli crimes. Israeli leaders must face justice for their crimes against the Palestinian people.
Tel Aviv also practices apartheid policies against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Among Israel's apartheid policies is the demolition of Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Israel also keeps thousands of Palestinian prisoners in its jails under inhumane detention conditions. Israeli forces also use excessive force to kill and maim peaceful Palestinian protesters in the blockaded Gaza Strip, as well as in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds.
Today we are here to prove that the crimes of the occupations against the Palestinians and the prisoners must be documented, and to support the Palestinians to obtain their rights.
Last month, at least 277 human rights groups and civil society organizations around the world denounced Israeli officials for imposing apartheid on Palestinians.
Observers say that Israel's apartheid against Palestinians is a cruel system of domination that constitutes a crime against humanity. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian arrived in Damascus heading a high-ranking delegation. He met with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and discussed the implementation of bilateral cooperation agreements. Talks covered cooperation in fighting terrorism, in which Abdullahian renewed Iran's support to Syria for the full liberation of all its territories. The top diplomat briefed President Assad on the Vienna talks on the revival of the JCPOA. Assad hailed Iran for adhering to principles and rights and the track adopted during the negotiations. He asserted that reaching a deal has become more important in service of Iran and the region's interest, as well as international equilibrium.
We had good meetings with President Assad and Foreign Minister Faisal Maqdad. We welcome the new approach by some Arab states in restoring relations with Syria. We reaffirmed Iran's readiness to develop relations with Syria and discuss increasing the level of tourist exchange. We hope that in the near future, the presidents of both countries would meet.
A separate meeting was also held between the foreign ministers of Syria and Iran. Focus was laid on the notable increase of trade exchange and means of overcoming the impact of economic sanctions on the two countries.
We discussed means of confronting unilateral illegal sanctions on both states, as well as developments currently happening in the meetings of the Syrian Constitutional Committee in Geneva. Syria and Iran's stances are identical in this regard. We are in favor of a successful result. However, the other side is not working for national interests.
Syria was the first destination of the regional tour of the Iranian delegation, which also includes Lebanon. Abdullahian's visit is one of many exchanged between both countries' officials. It signals the extensive and continuous cooperation between the two allies at all times, which resulted in a defeat of terror in Syria and currently aims to boost economic partnerships. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Poland's support for fellow Europeans fleeing Ukraine is receiving much praise. However, this has been a huge turnaround, for in past years, the Eastern European country has been heavily criticized for a proud anti-immigration stance, particularly hostile towards Muslim refugees.
Angela Merkel started this madness, and now this is a problem about Muslims mainly coming to Europe.
Amid the anti-Islam rhetoric, Press TV decided to investigate how local Muslims live under these types of challenges.
The Muslim community that lives here in Poland is small but very passionate. It's estimated somewhere between 25 to 40,000 Muslims currently live in the country, making up about 0.1% of the current population, as it's estimated. The majority of them are native Tatars, but also there has been an immigration of Muslims to Poland from various countries. We've come here to one of the main mosques in the capital, Warsaw, to meet the community firsthand.
The imam explains that his main focus has always been to re-educate Poles about Islam and demonstrate Islamic teachings through good deeds.
We teach Quran, we teach Arabic language, and we teach something about Islam. Yes. During Ramadan, because Ramadan is near now, we're making soon 1992, we're making food and iftar for everybody. Every day. From time to time, also, we're making open day. This is for non-Muslims to come to our mosque, to hear something and listen about Islam. We made in March open day, and during this activity, 5 women accept Islam.
Despite these successes, Islamophobia still rears its ugly head from time to time. But the mosque uses Islam to combat this also.
One time only, the Polish youth came in front of this masjid and said some bad words about Islam. But I went to them and invited them to here to take a cup of tea, and they became friendly.
In past years, it was Islamic immigration that was considered the major threat in Eastern Europe. Now it's Russia. But conflict in Europe has historically catapulted dangerous ideologies into the forefront. Muslims in Europe look on with caution. Robert Carter, Warsaw.
Yemen's Eye of Humanity Center for Rights and Development has held a press conference in the capital Sana'a to release its latest statistics of 7 years of Saudi Arabia's war and siege on its neighboring Arab country. The report says more than 46,000 civilians have been killed or injured, including women and the children.
During 7 years, the Saudi-led coalition committed horrific crimes amounting to genocide. There were 46,262 civilians who got killed and wounded as a result of the direct targeting of the Saudi-led coalition's aircraft, including more than 8,000 children and 5,000 women. There is also systematic destruction and targeting of service and economic infrastructure. And the Saudi coalition's air force continues to target roads, bridges, and civilian objects to this day.
The report says more than 500,000 homes were destroyed due to Saudi Arabia's air attacks and thousands of families were displaced. Also, the figures show further destruction of the country's infrastructure.
For 7 years, Saudi Arabia has committed war crimes against Yemeni civilians, but unfortunately, the international community did not fulfill its duty to stop these crimes. Therefore, we see today the Yemeni army intensifying its operations against Saudi territories, and this is a legitimate right, as it is self-defense.
Since the beginning of the war, Saudi Arabia has clearly violated international law multiple times by targeting residential areas across Yemen using cluster munitions. However, this has not pushed the international community to take any measures against Riyadh's war crimes.
After 7 years of killing and destruction in Yemen, observers say Saudi Arabia has not achieved any of its announced goals. On the contrary, Riyadh is facing more retaliatory attacks by the Yemeni forces deep inside its territory. Abdul Latif, Sana'a.
This is the second OIC conference Pakistan hosted in 3 months. In December, foreign ministers from the OIC held an extraordinary session to discuss the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. But the latest session was a regular one with an ambitious agenda on the table. Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan opened the conference while regretting how the OIC failed both the people of Palestine and Kashmir.
We have failed both the Palestinians and the people of Kashmir. I'm sad to say that we have been able to make no impact at all. They don't take us seriously. We are a divided house, and those powers know it.
For the first time, the Chinese foreign minister attended the OIC conference as a special guest. In his speech, Wang, he said Beijing wants to work closely with the Islamic countries.
China stands ready to work with the Islamic countries to actively advocate true multilateralism, safeguard the purposes and principles of the UN Charter, uphold the UN-centered international system.
The issue of Ukraine also came up for discussions. The OIC Secretary General stressed the need for political solution to the crisis, as he feared the conflict would endanger international peace and stability. The OIC conference coincided with Pakistan Day celebrations. The delegates also attended the National Day parade.
The two-day conference concluded with OIC members adopting over 100 resolutions. But observers believe that Islamic countries representing 1.5 billion people need to make a difference through actions, as mere statements are not enough. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Cartoons often have the power, by drawing attention quickly and getting straight to the point, to uncover deceit and deliver uncomfortable, shocking messages. In a span of over 25 years since the early 60s, late Palestinian cartoonist Naji al-Ali produced over 40,000 drawings and several books of cartoons, raising awareness on the Palestinian plight at the hands of Israeli settlers and harshly criticizing Arab regimes and the U.S. imperialistic policies. Today, a book containing tens of cartoons by al-Ali has been published for the first time in Italy.
We have published this book because presently the Palestinian struggle has been put on hold. Nobody talks about it anymore, but the Israeli occupation continues and the elimination of an entire population is ongoing. Ali and his character, Handala, serve as an example of how a cartoon can be more useful than an intifada to stop the occupation and lift the veil of lies covering Palestine.
Naji al-Ali's most famous character is Handala, a 10-year-old barefoot child dressed in ragged clothes. The boy, always drawn from behind while watching all the bad that is happening on earth, has over time become a symbol of the Palestinian resistance, giving voice to the poor and oppressed. This year marks the 35th anniversary of the assassination of Handala's creator Naji al-Ali, as he was murdered outside a newspaper office in the UK in 1987. 5 years ago, London's police department reopened its investigation into the unsolved murder of the Palestinian political cartoonist.
Naji al-Ali's work was for a long time reflective of the Palestinian cause. His cartoons were very critical of everybody involved in the Palestinian plight. Handala means bitter in Arabic and well represents the struggle of the Palestinians. The fact that the boy was drawn from behind meant that everybody, including the Arabic world, had turned their back to Palestine. Al-Ali's assassination was plotted by dark powers, certainly close to the Mossad.
Naji al-Ali's book was recently launched in Naples. It will also be presented in several other Italian cities, including Rome, Genoa, and Bologna. Max Civili, Rome.
On World Water Day, water pollution has reached an alarming level in the besieged Gaza Strip. The enclave's coastal aquifer is almost completely polluted with various contaminants. The groundwater in Gaza has high levels of nitrates and other dangerous pollutants, with contamination levels 3 times higher than international standards for safe drinking water. The Israeli regime has imposed tight restrictions on the entry of badly needed equipment to maintain water and sewer systems and targeted them during wars.
Today, about 98% of our municipal water wells, drinking water wells, their water quality does not fit with the WHO standards related to the drinking water standards.
In recent years, Gaza municipalities were forced to pump untreated raw sewage directly into the sea due to lack of electricity for treatment plants. Raw sewage seepage into the ground has worsened the water crisis. Palestinian officials say Israel has for years deprived residents of Gaza of healthy water supply and stolen their underground resources.
Israel tried to steal our groundwater by having their pumping wells along the eastern border of Gaza Strip and preventing the flow of groundwater by gravity, by lowering the water table and reverse the direction of the groundwater at that location.
The Israeli blockade and wars have taken their toll on Gaza's water infrastructure. Experts say the tiny seaside sliver is currently in a chronic state of water emergency.
Gaza is suffering due to the water catastrophe with full meaning. Shortage of water, and at the same time we have polluted water. We are calling on the international community in order to end this blockade, which is one of the main reasons for such catastrophe that we are living in.
According to human rights organizations, depriving people of water supplies is a clear breach of international law.
On World Water Day, experts say that the complete lifting of the Israeli blockade is the first step towards easing the water crisis in the coastal enclave. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Congratulations to all at the arrival of a spring and revival of nature.
In the limelight.
Donald Trump's former strategist Steve Bannon is advancing a high-stakes defense as he battles a case that could mean up to a year in federal prison and thousands of dollars in fines if convicted. We now present you an article written by Hugo Lowell. The piece is titled Bannon's Escape Plan: How the Trump Strategist is Trying to Dodge Prison. As the House Select Committee investigating the 6th of January Capitol attack was negotiating with Donald Trump's former strategist Steve Bannon to cooperate with its inquiry, the panel affirmed one of their rules. No third-party lawyers could attend witness depositions. That meant when Steve Bannon's then-attorney asked whether a lawyer for Trump could be present for the closed-door interview to decide what issues were covered by the former president's invocation of executive privilege, the select committee flatly refused. Now, that refusal appears set to feature as one of Steve Bannon's central arguments to defend against his contempt of Congress indictment that came after he entirely skipped his deposition last October and refused to produce documents as required by his subpoena. The former Trump aide is advancing a high-stakes and arcane-sounding defense as he battles the Justice Department in a case that could mean up to a year in federal prison and thousands of dollars in fines if convicted. But potentially defang congressional power should he prevail. The all-or-nothing nature of the defense is characteristic of Steve Bannon, a fierce defender and confidant of former U.S. President Donald Trump, even after he departed the White House 7 months into the Trump administration after a turbulent tenure as his chief strategist. It was precisely because of his contacts with Donald Trump in the days before 6th of January 2021 that the House Select Committee made Bannon one of the panel's first subpoena targets, as it seeks to uncover whether Donald Trump oversaw a criminal conspiracy that culminated in the Capitol attack. The crux of Steve Bannon's argument is that he could reasonably believe the subpoena was invalid when the House Select Committee refused to allow a Trump lawyer to attend the deposition after the former president asserted executive privilege over the materials covered by the subpoena. The argument rests on a 2019 Justice Department Office of Legal Counsel opinion that says congressional subpoenas that prevent executive branch counsel from accompanying executive branch employees to depositions are legally invalid and not enforceable. Steve Bannon's attorneys say the doctrine at issue is protecting the president's constitutional authority to limit the disclosure of privileged information, which typically involves discussions with close presidential aides who need to be able to offer candid advice. In that sense, the principle extends to Steve Bannon, they argue. The Supreme Court decided in Nixon versus GSA 1977 that former presidents could assert executive privilege, while a 2007 Office of Legal Counsel opinion found executive privilege could cover discussions with private, non-executive branch employee advisors. And since the House Select Committee issued only one subpoena for both documents and testimony, when the subpoena was invalidated by the panel's refusal to allow a Trump lawyer to attend the meeting, Steve Bannon's attorneys contend the document request element of the subpoena also became void. David Schoen, one of three attorneys defending Steve Bannon in this case, the others are Evan Corcoran and Bob Costello, told The Guardian in a text message, "We don't read Office of Legal Counsel opinions in isolation." They added, "They build on each other." The Justice Department does not think the Office of Legal Counsel opinions protect Steve Bannon, in part because he was not an executive branch employee at the time of 6th of January 2021. And the House Select Committee contends Donald Trump did not formally assert executive privilege over subpoenaed materials. The Assistant U.S. Attorney, Amanda Wogan, also indicated in recent court filings that Steve Bannon's argument that the subpoena was invalid because House deposition rules excluded third-party lawyers was in bad faith, since his then-attorney, Bob Costello, never raised it as an issue at the time. Amanda Wogan said in the Justice Department's response to Steve Bannon, "Costello inquired, but said that he did not need an immediate answer, whether there was a way for a lawyer for President Trump to appear at the defendant's deposition. But Steve Bannon won an initial victory under dispute recently after a judge in the case ordered the Justice Department to turn over Office of Legal Counsel writings about its position on prosecuting current or former U.S. officials claiming immunity from congressional subpoenas over executive privilege. U.S. District Judge Carl Nichols granted the request by Bannon's attorneys, who suggest Costello was relying on the Office of Legal Counsel opinions to current and former White House aides when he advised Steve Bannon not to appear for his deposition since the House Select Committee subpoena was invalid. A spokesman for the House Select Committee and a spokesman for the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia declined to comment. The defense that Steve Bannon is advancing, using broad readings of parts of the Justice Department's own positions and amalgamating them into a wider argument, is controversial, but it underscores the complexities facing the Justice Department in pursuing the case. Jonathan Shoeb, a law professor at the University of Kentucky and a former Office of Legal Counsel Attorney Advisor, said, "Steve Bannon's trying to use the Office of Legal Counsel opinions as a shield that doesn't quite cover him, but gives him enough of a defense to fend off the Department of Justice's necessity of proving criminal intent. To establish criminal contempt of Congress, the Justice Department has to prove Bannon's subpoena defiance was willful, which Bannon's attorneys say should be interpreted as meaning whether the former Trump aide knew his conduct was unlawful or wrong. His attorneys say the combined force of Bannon's arguments demonstrate that he did not know his defiance was unlawful, and shifts the burden onto the Justice Department to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Steve Bannon did not believe the privilege claims were valid." Former Trump aide Steve Bannon is also coupling the argument that the subpoena was invalid with the defenses that he relied on the advice of counsel when he defied the subpoena, and that he cannot be prosecuted because Office of Legal Counsel opinions, considered binding on the Justice Department, forbid it. Bannon's attorneys say the former Trump aide ignored his subpoena entirely on the advice of Bob Costello, who relied on the Office of Legal Counsel opinions about immunity for former presidential aides and was the only point of contact with the Select Committee during negotiations about his cooperation. It is far from clear whether Steve Bannon will prevail. In a recent hearing, Judge Nichols cast doubt on the advice of counsel argument, noting that the relevant case law, Licavoli v. United States, 1961, holds that relying on legal advice to defy a subpoena is no defense. The Justice Department argued in their brief that the interpretation of willful should in fact remain the standard established by the Licavoli Court. A deliberate and intentional failure to appear or produce records as required by a congressional subpoena. But Steve Bannon's lawyers have noted that the Licavoli case did not involve executive privilege and therefore does not apply to Steve Bannon, not least because the Justice Department has itself maintained that executive privilege cases are unique because of the constitutional implications. Professor Shoeb said of Steve Bannon, "He's reaching for all the straws that he can. It may succeed or it may not, but if Judge Nichols rules against him, he's certainly going to take it to the D.C. Circuit or even up to the Supreme Court. He's definitely playing a longer game here."
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of The Lantern. I think it goes without dispute that one of the most important, essential, vital factors that can make any relationship, whether it's platonic, romantic, business, friendship, whatever, any family ties, even with strangers. Any relationship work out properly is communication. Communication doesn't just mean the use of words. It means the ability to transfer information between two or more people. And this description often relies on several other factors in addition to words and verbs. Let's listen to a short little anecdote that I remember often when I'm at a loss for words or my voice rises a bit more than its usual resting place. It's an interesting one. Let's listen to it real quick and we'll be right back.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah the Almighty. Dear brothers and sisters, salam. So welcome to another episode of Lantern with a nice story. The title of today's story is Language of Love. A wise old man saw his grandson having a heated discussion with his wife. He asked his grandson, "Why do you raise your voice when you are arguing with your wife?" Grandson said, "I lose patience when she doesn't understand my point of view, and that is why I raise my voice." Grandfather said, "But your wife is close enough for her to hear you even when you say the same sentence in a calm manner. Why do you have to raise your voice?" His grandson said, "I raise my voice so that my voice is heard and I can also let out the steam by raising my voice." Grandfather said, "That is not the exact reason for you to raise your voice. The real reason is that when you're angry with your wife, your heart moves away from her heart. So even though you're physically close to each other, you feel that you're far away from one another and hence raise your voice." His grandson replied, "If that is the reason for raising the voice, what do we do when we are in love?" Grandfather said, "When two people are in love, their hearts are close to each other. Even if you whisper softly, you both can hear very clearly. At such time, one can communicate with the loved ones even through the language of silence." Yes, as William James says, whenever you're in conflict with someone, there is one factor that can make a difference between damaging your relationship and deepening it. That factor is attitude.
Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
So, as the story indicates, one of those factors that makes communication functional and fruitful and gives it any sort of benefit is really the volume of our voices. Being able to speak with a low, soft voice is a virtue. Obviously, the noble prophet and the infallibles and the messengers of God possess this virtue, and it is really a representation of a person's character. In fact, even the Quran tells us that Allah doesn't really like it when people raise their voice and yell and shout for apparently no reason, unless they are being oppressed and it's a cry for help. And I find that very interesting that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala distincts this singular instance to be an exception for the detestedness of raising one's voice when speaking. There's a saying or a poem in English attributed to Rumi, though to be honest, I've never come across the Persian, that don't raise your voice when speaking to others and trying to be understood. It's the rain that helps the plant go. It's the rain that helps the plant grow, not the thunder. And unless someone is really far away from us and the distance requires us to raise our voice so that our voice can be heard, I really can't think of any circumstances where a speech presented louder would make it more influential. Like, or unless, you know, like really, you're standing at a podium and there's a crowd, you're on a stage, or you're in a studio and the microphone requires you to speak with a certain level, or someone's in the other room. Other than that, with kids, with our parents, whom we're not even supposed to say uff to, as the Quran states, with our loved ones, especially with our partners, raising our voice is never the solution, and it has never helped. It's never resolved or fixed any conflict. In fact, on the contrary, it's probably even made it worse. Once one of the parties or both of them begin to raise their voices, that's when you know stuff is hitting the fan. And, you know, they probably at this point need to back off from each other a little and take some time to cool down, process what just happened, choose their words more wisely, try to wait for their emotions to de-escalate a little, and be able to reapproach the topic and the discussion in a more sound, civilized manner. Even when it comes to children, we can see that they begin to raise their voices when they feel unheard and they feel frustrated and they can't find the right words to express themselves. And I think that just shows that raising our voice is not necessarily our natural state, unless, you know, certain cultures, we see that they are innately loud people. But even them, I think even if you search among them, the wise and the sage and the learned and those who are scholarly or those who are self-refined tend to have lower volumes when they speak. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul
qulub. IRIB English Radio.